This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'll begin today with jobs, segue seamlessly into economic patriotism, take a brief detour to big box retail, and end with House of Cards. Not so bad for a Wednesday, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 23rd of July. Glad you could be with us on this Wednesday, everybody. All right, so listen, there I was, driving into work this morning, listening as I was to my local public radio station, tuned to my colleague David Boncaccio on the Marketplace Morning Report. He was talking to David Kelly at J.P. Morgan Funds about the corporate earnings season we are in the middle of. And at one point, Kelly said this.
It's a pretty good picture. Overall, right now, we've about 38% of the market cap of the S&P 500 has reported, so almost 40% of the money is in the door. Right now, it looks like an all-time record high for operating earnings in the second quarter.
Did you catch that? All-time record high. We asked yesterday what companies are doing with all that money. Well, here's today's answer. They are not hiring you. Marketplace's Bree Benishore takes it from there.
Cash, assets, money. Businesses in the U.S. have a lot of it these days.
$16.4 trillion.
Joel Prakken is co-founder of Macroeconomic Advisors.
The ratio of assets to GDP it's almost 100%. It's very, very high.
Every dollar spent in the U.S. economy in a year, that's how much money businesses are holding in cash or securities. It's a lot of money, but a lot of it was earned abroad. So it's not necessarily a reflection of a healthy U.S. economy.
We've had, you know, very modest economic growth really for the last 4 years. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Scott Wren is with Wells Fargo Advisors. He says not much of that money is being spent creating jobs, and there's good reason for that.
And a lot of businesses felt like the U.S. economy was ready to roll over into another recession.
Caution and fear do not promote hiring, but that is only part of the story. It turns out businesses are trying to hire a little bit. Matt Slaughter is dean of Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
There were 4.6 million open jobs in May, up by 700,000 over the past year.
But firms are running into trouble filling those open positions. They're so desperate that yearly quotas for hiring high-skilled immigrants filled up in 4 days with a record number of applications.
So a lot of companies are not finding the right kind of technical or other skills that they need to fill some of the jobs they are looking to hire for.
But maybe there's a bigger explanation. A lot of economists are wondering about this. Maybe higher corporate profits and lower employment, maybe that's the new normal. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This economy is not all companies that are in the S&P 500, of course. Small businesses do their share of the heavy lifting and the hiring as well. Olala Njenga is the CEO of Yellowwood Group. That's a strategic marketing firm in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we call her up from time to time to see how things are going. Olala, it's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me back, Kai.
So let's see. We had you on. I'm looking at the screen now. January the 9th, it was a Thursday. We were talking about jobs, and you said, yeah, you know, I'm doing all right now. And the question is, 6 months later, in a growing economy, are you still doing all right?
We're still doing okay. You're catching us at a time of year that is naturally a little bit slow for us. Q3 tends to be a little bit just because of the nature of our business. But I think that, you know, optimism is there. I like to say we're hopeful, but, you know, across any area of the business, you know, hope doesn't get employees paid, right?
Yeah, so, no, it absolutely does not. That $2 gets you on the bus.
There you go.
tell me about your team. How many people do you have working for you? And are you thinking or are you able to grow that team at all?
We always need a core team of four because of the nature of our business. And then we have a supplemental team. So right now, supplemental talent is abundant. But the core team talent is where we continue to have challenges just because we need an interesting skill set when someone walks in the door. And I'm not alone. There's a lot of small business owners out there looking for that, you know, a superstar person who is flexible and creative and only needs to be groomed against the values and the culture of the company. But they come in the door with a really nice set of skills. And so, you know, I'm not whining. It is what it is. Yeah, you know, yeah, and I'm not alone, right?
No, absolutely. Well, speaking of that, can I infer from you saying that it's a little slow-ish right now and confidence is waning, can I infer that your customers then, the people for whom you do the strategic marketing consultation, are also feeling kind of meh?
And that's the new word for 2014 is meh, you know? They are. And it's kind of where it's being driven by. And what a lot of people don't understand, the nature of small business is driven by optimism indices across many areas. So we're consumers first. Mm-hmm. So if if people are squeamish about spending money personally, they look at things like what's happening in the automobile industry, what's happening in housing. The issue that we run into is if there's any area that makes people feel meh,
yeah,
it spills over into the small business sector.
Now, just to before I let you go, as you look now at the second half of 2014, mm-hmm. my guess is that you being a naturally optimistic person are thinking things are going to pick up.
Absolutely. We have some things in the work right now where we are productizing one of our flagship services.
Oh, there you go.
So we're excited that we may be able to take something that has traditionally been a service and translate it into a product. Yeah. And it is launching this quarter. So I'll have to touch base with you about that and tell you how
no
it goes.
Joke. Well, you got to innovate, right? That's the name of the game.
There you go. Yeah.
Olala Njenga, she is the CEO of Yellowwood Group out in Raleigh, North Carolina. Olala, thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
On Wall Street today, come on, what else could it be? Meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama has been on the road of late, as you know, trying to get traction for his economic message that things are getting better and would keep on getting better if only Republicans in Congress would come around. The president has a phrase he's been using a lot that caught our ear. Economic patriotism is what he likes to say. Here it is in context from a speech in Denver a couple of weeks ago.
So we can rally America around an economic patriotism that says don't give tax breaks to millionaires, billionaires, let's give more tax breaks to help working families pay for child care or college.
Marketplace's David Gura has more on the etymology of an economic stump speech.
President Obama may have cribbed the term from a speech former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland gave at the 2012 Democratic National Convention. He was talking about the Republican nominee, Mitt Romney.
Mitt has so little economic patriotism that even his money needs a passport.
Obama used the phrase in a TV ad soon after, and it became the title of the president's economic plan. I asked Strickland how he defines economic patriotism.
Companies, corporations, CEOs need to understand that this country has provided them and continues to provide for them the means to be successful.
Economic patriotism is more of a rhetorical device than an economic theory. There's no textbook definition. President Obama's used it to talk about infrastructure investment. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew used it in a letter to lawmakers about corporate taxation. Economic historian Gavin Wright, who teaches at Stanford, suggests economic patriotism is a broad brush. It refers to appeals to make economic behavior or economic policy based on American values. And he says it's happened throughout history.
During the Cold War era, I don't recall hearing the term economic patriotism, but it was more or less taken as a given.
In the 1790s, Wright says, Alexander Hamilton asked the government to support manufacturers. It was an appeal to help a special interest group.
But he also thought this would be essential for the credibility of the American economy, American nation.
The phrase economic patriotism has been used by Democrats and Republicans, by Pat Buchanan and by John Bonn, who ran the Export-Import Bank during the Reagan era. He defines economic patriotism as understanding our economic policy as it compares to other countries.
We need to have a a kind of a partnership between the government and the private sector if we are going to maximize our economic growth.
Over these last few weeks, the phrase has attracted criticism. Stanford's Gavin Wright summarizes one complaint.
There's a market out there, and the market operates and reaches its outcome, and the government wants to intervene and change that.
So, he says, the debate over the definition of the term economic patriotism is really a proxy for a much bigger debate over the role government should play in the economy. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Federal Aviation Administration has extended for another 24 hours its ban on U.S. airlines flying to Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. The actual language of the ban, it's technically called a notice to airmen, says flights to and from Tel Aviv are, quote, prohibited. But sometimes the FAA uses less categorical language, allowing for some interpretation in aviation. So what's an airline to do as it weighs the risks of flying somewhere or not flying there? Sally Herships has more on that.
Although the FAA has banned American companies flying to Israel, potentially dangerous countries like Sudan, Chad, Pakistan, and Niger only have warnings. So how is an airline supposed to know where it's safe to fly?
Airlines don't make that decision alone.
Michael Boyd is an aviation industry consultant. He works with big airlines. He says, take the case of Malaysian flight MH17, recently shot down over Ukraine. Lots of entities were involved in the decision in letting the plane fly there. Bodies like Eurocontrol, Europe's answer to air traffic controllers.
There were over 400 airplanes the prior week that did the same flight, not a problem. So there was no strong indication that there was a threat at that point in time.
And when a route is potentially dangerous, Boyd says the U.S. State Department issues warnings. Passengers don't want to fly, so airlines cancel flights. But Henry Hardeveld, an industry analyst with Atmosphere Research, says the decision about where and when to fly can be much more complex.
It may be political relationships between the countries. It may be commercial ties between the countries.
Hardeveld says if airlines have to fly around problem regions, they have to be sure they can accommodate additional flying time, as well as costs for fuel and crew.
Airlines are commercial businesses. They are there to earn a profit for their investors as well as provide safe transportation.
And safety is what a couple of the big carriers say is their top priority. Take American Airlines. It's canceled its flights to Tel Aviv today and tomorrow. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It's entirely possible we're going to have to come up with some new nomenclature for those giant retail chains, y'all. Big box, we call them now, right? Except Target keeps trying to wedge itself into smaller and smaller stores. The company has already made a play for urban customers with its scaled-down city Targets. But even those can be five times as big as its new offering, a Target Express store that opened today in a neighborhood of Minneapolis called, I kid you not, Dinky Town. So, big brand, shrinking stores. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at what Target might be up to.
When you walk into the new Target Express, the size alone kind of feels more like a Walgreens or CVS than a big box. But you're assailed by the Target brand at every turn. The workers' red shirts, the bright red signage. You can get some of the same stuff, like electronics, groceries, or even underwear that are in the bigger Target stores. But as Erica Winkles, a spokeswoman, explains, there's just a lot less of it.
We do have, you know, sort of socks, T-shirts, things like that.
So if you really need, like, just really basic stuff, then...
With no quarters for laundry. Here you go.
Also, a lot of the clothing, it's got the University of Minnesota logo on it. The school is just a couple blocks away. Target's going after college kids and other carless urbanites who just need a place to grab milk or a toothbrush on the run.
It's these fill-in trips, these in-between, those big shopping stock-up trips that... It's the biggest opportunity in retail right now.
Carol Speakerman is president of New Market Builders, a retail strategy firm. She says Target and Walmart, which are both trying out small formats, can also use the mini stores to connect shoppers to other products outside the stores so they can buy them online. A tablet in the Target Express lets you do that. But for Josh Egge, the Target Express's value is its location. He manages a rental property near the new store and wants to tell potential tenants there are grocery options nearby.
In the past, I've had to tell them to walk five blocks and take a bus 2 miles or whatever, but so this will be actually really nice.
Target says it plans to open 4 more Express stores next year. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Those numbers can lead to either forced choices that have nothing to do with the creative process or, to, you know, conversely, a form of pandering.
Bo Willimon from House of Cards on why he doesn't pay ratings. No, never mind. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off a 10% today, 26 points, closed at 17,086. The NASDAQ added 0.4%, 17 points, 44.73. The S&P 500 gained a 10%, 3 points, finished at 1987. That, by the by, is a record high. Earnings ruled today again. Apple picked up more than 2.5% after reporting earnings yesterday and signaling the new iPhone is on the way. Boeing also reported better than expected earnings, but its shares fell more than 2% on other worries, and that helped drag down the entire Dow Jones Industrial Average. Facebook was up nearly 3% at the bell. The stock got another boost after hours after the company reported stronger earnings and big jumps in mobile ads and active users. Bonds stood still yet again. The yield on the 10-year T-note at 2.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for June. A forum hosted by Zillow focuses on the future of housing in the U.S. One topic on the agenda, how to house the millennial generation. And it's a day to celebrate an American tradition, enjoying a meal in your parked car. Tomorrow is National Drive-Thru Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Marketing can get at you pretty much any place nowadays. We all kind of know that, and yet ad campaigns still manage to sneak up on us. There have been some viral videos out there lately aimed at women and girls and their parents. They're all about female strength. Being a strong woman is probably a better way to put that. They kind of look like public service announcements, except they're from companies like Verizon Wireless and Procter & Gamble, and millions of people are watching them voluntarily. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
In this online ad for Always Feminine Products, there's no pitch for an actual product. Instead, a documentary maker sits behind a monitor. She asks several young adults to do this.
Show me what it looks like to run like a girl.
Each runner flails around, arms flapping, head flopping from side to side. It's a parody of uncoordinated running. Then...
My name is Dakota, and I'm 10 years old.
Show me what it looks like to run like a girl.
The little girl races on the spot, like an athlete. No flailing, no flopping. The point? Preteens haven't yet absorbed the message that doing anything like a girl means doing it badly.
These ads are putting their finger on something that we all know is true but rarely talk about.
Rachel Simmons is co-founder of the Girls Leadership Institute.
In adolescence, there is a precipitous loss of self-esteem that girls experience. And this ad explained what was happening and validated the experience of millions of parents.
Which may explain why it's been viewed more than 40 million times. Jody Detchen is a management professor at Suffolk University in Boston. So why are marketers pushing messages about female strength and ability? Detchen says they're capitalizing on a national movement.
You've got all these organizations trying to figure out how to get more women leaders. You've got all this pressure on Silicon Valley to get more women involved.
Not to mention the push to get more young women to take up science and technology careers. She says if advertisers want to get on board too, that's fine with her.
Because of the complexity of the problem, I think we need all these different approaches. So it's just like this perfect storm.
Rachel Simmons says, look, it's not ideal. She'd rather girls learn this stuff from their parents, not a YouTube video.
I want every girl to have her teacher tell her to stop apologizing, not a shampoo commercial. But if we don't live in that world, I don't want to throw out the commercial just on principle.
That shampoo commercial she's talking about?
Sorry, can I ask a stupid question?
Pantene made the ad.
Sorry.
Sorry.
It focuses on some women's tendency to preface their words with an apology. Then the ad urges them to stop being sorry and start having faith in themselves.
I have a question. Why don't we go back to the original thing that we did?
Pantene teamed up with the American Association of University Women to promote the campaign and help it reach a millennial audience. But some women, like Stephanie Holland, don't relate to this particular commercial. They don't like that the ad encourages women to change their behavior. Holland writes the She Economy blog about women's marketing power. She's also run her own ad agency for 30 years. For a long time, she did change her behavior.
I have, over time, realized that I had to act like a man to be successful.
And with hindsight, she regrets that. So if over-apologizing is more of a woman thing, she says, so what? Why can't women today be themselves at work, just like men?
At the end of the day, it's saying that we should change and not them, that they're right and we're wrong.
Holland says some differences between the sexes are okay, and she's not sorry. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
I think I've mentioned a couple of times this year that we've got a road show we're doing across the country, kind of a live version of Marketplace. It's built around a theme, a through line, if you will, how we learn to stop worrying and love the numbers. We took it up to the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado a couple of weeks ago, where we had Bo Willimon on. He's the guy behind House of Cards, one of the breakout hits for Netflix the past couple of years. We're going to play that interview today as part of our series this week, talking to people at the top of their fields about how they do what they do. And we jumped right into the theme of the day. You are maybe the ultimate how I learned to stop worrying and love the numbers, because on that issue of ratings, Netflix, which knows granularly what its customers do, does not share that information with you, the guy who put it on the map in content.
I know virtually nothing.
Does that not make you...
So we're done, right?
Yeah, no. Thanks for coming.
No,
doesn't that make you crazy?
No, I love it. The problem with creativity and where it brushes up against numbers, particularly as it has to do with, you know, the commodification of, you know, an artistic endeavor, is that those numbers can lead to either forced choices that have nothing to do with the creative process, or to, you know, conversely, coming from the creative side, a form of pandering, because you become obsessed with those numbers and try to cater to them. So I don't have to deal with any of that.
The criticism goes, you know, if you as the showrunner would see that viewers respond significantly to one plot point, you would just repeat that endlessly so that they would keep coming back to that and watching that show, right?
Yeah, or I could say, I'm just going to mess with that almost out of spite in a way. If people are asking for this one character more and more and more, I don't want to feel like I'm pandering, so therefore I might intentionally do the opposite unless I'm getting corporate pressure or whatever. All that really matters is, from my perspective, is that clearly whatever numbers exist that Netflix knows on a granular level are enough to make them happy. And if they're happy, that means that they have a business model that's working for them. That's all I need to know.
Did you know going in that Ted Sarandos, the head of content at Netflix, was not going to share that data with you?
No, we weren't entirely sure. I mean, when we sat down with Ted and Cindy Holland for the first time, they said, we're going to give you 2 seasons guaranteed, which was pretty groundbreaking at the time.
Right.
It still is. And they said, we're going to give you creative freedom. We believe in the team and what you guys want to make. Go and do your thing. We knew what sort of access they had to this incredible reservoir of data.
Right.
I mean, we sat down with their sort of chief mastermind who told us like how much that, you know, they can find out just from your viewing habits. But they were pretty emphatic from the get-go that they weren't going to heap this stuff on top of us. We didn't know how much we'd get. And I do get a certain amount of data, but I to this day, I can't tell you how many Americans have watched House of Cards.
Lots. Show of hands?
You know,
come on. Anybody? Yeah, there you go.
You know, a lot of it's anecdotal.
Yeah.
For me.
You alluded to it. There's another number that is really significant. You have said about this program, the guaranteed 2-season deal you got. Why did that matter to you so much as the creative guy?
See, for me, that matters a lot more than releasing all the episodes on one day, which is really just responding to a trend that was already under the way when you started to have subscription services like HBO, where numbers like ratings ceased to become as important for a whole host of reasons. But for me, knowing that I had 26 hours meant that I had a broad canvas that I could paint on. I knew that there were things I could lay in early on in season one that might not fully come back to the end of season two. So you can really delve deeper into characters. You don't feel rushed. You don't have to force big cliffhangers or jump the shark in order to try to make something dramatic happen unorganically, the way that some shows feel the pressure to because they're in a ratings game week to week fighting for their life.
Did you go in and say, listen, we want a 1-season deal and we're not going to shoot a pilot? Or
we said that to everyone. We said to initially we sat down with the AMC Showtime, and HBO. We were very strategic sort of when we leaked this project to the press and gave them the material. And we said, we don't want to audition. I mean, it's kind of a hubristic thing to say. Netflix came in and we said, we want a full season order. And they said, oh, yeah, no problem. Two seasons.
Wow.
You know. So now what you're seeing a lot of is places like HBO or other networks are doing full season orders now.
And Netflix is doing them again. I mean, Orange is the New Black and all that stuff. You are, as the showrunner, the guy who sits between the executives who have all that data, and the rest of the creative staff. How do you filter what they need to know about how they are doing? I mean, they get the adulation in the press, and I'm sure Kevin and Robin read all this stuff, but how do you sort of calibrate that?
No one sits, I'm on set every day from the first day to 100 day 155 or whatever it is. Never, I can honestly say, if any of us sat around saying, gosh, we really knew what these numbers were. You know, we believe.
Which is so funny because broadcast television, you can't turn around without somebody saying, oh, well, your cum last night or your, you know, the overnights and all this stuff.
You know, it's like you can't get addicted to heroin if it's not available to you. You know, it's like.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
I mean,
do you worry about getting addicted to the numbers? If you knew, would you?
I have friends that are constantly contending with these numbers who work on broad, you know, traditional broadcast networks, and I think that they wish they didn't have to deal with those numbers more often than not. All we really care about, I mean, it's like a little bubble, is the work that we're trying to do that day, trying to tell the best story we can. We're constantly contending with our own sense of self-doubt and self-loathing, which is far worse than dealing with any, you know, data set. And ultimately, as long as someone is willing to keep paying for us to do the thing that we love and hate ourselves for doing, then, you know, we're good to go.
You're shooting season 3 now, right?
That's right. We're about a month into filming season 3.
And when do we get it?
I wish I could tell you.
Oh, man. Come on.
That is a piece of data I do know, but I can't share yet.
Bo Willimon, thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, not to pick on GM, but it does bear a mention that the company issued another recall today, 700,000 vehicles. That brings the total number of cars and trucks that GM wants back just for this year to 28.77 million. That's million with an M. This being capitalism, GM shares off 1% today. All right, we're done. We got to skedaddle. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.